and pulled his other friends for the occasion from the different bands on the bill. I discovered this massive pool of musicians out there who love the Dead's material and get off playing it wherever they can, Lesh told the Denver Post in advance of the show at Red Rocks Amphitheater. I'm trying to tap into that concept of treating it as repertoire material and finding new doors, as it were, from these guys and myself. While they still used Cameron Sears at the office to make and take calls on their behalf, the business strategy behind Phil Lesh's career began to emanate more and more directly from his wife, who finally underwent her thyroid cancer surgery in June. With Lesh absent from his official duties and the office more frequently, McQuaid would often volunteer to take copies of minutes or other documents over to his house. Explaining his absence from the office and meetings, Lesh complained about the stress, so McQuaid would show up only to find his wife acting as a surrogate. Interestingly, Jan Simmons had run into Jill at the baby shower for Natasha Munter, Weir's future wife, in late 1997, before Lesh's transplant. Simmons had left the Dead office to go work with Deborah Santana, the wife of the lead guitarist, who had started managing her husband's affairs. During the conversation, Simmons couldn't help but notice that when Jill realized that Carlos Santana's wife was officially acting as his manager, her eyes lit up. Shortly after Garcia died, Lesh expressed an interest in serving as chairman of GDP and was given the post. He was closely overseeing the Dead's reissue program, deeply involved in Terrapin Station, and initially supportive of the Bandwagon project at the time, not playing music with Phil and friends. The band's business advisors had difficulties with his obsessive reluctance to sign documents. However, he did chair board meetings and took an active role until his veto power was overruled. For years, the Dead had operated under unanimous rule. Only policies universally approved by band members would be adopted. In that way, at their 80s peak, Lesh had been able to keep the band from making new studio albums for more than 6 years, declaring the recording studio too clinical a place to make music. And at a time when the band was playing before stadiums full of fans, and demand for their records had never been greater. The other band members finally settled the argument by renting Marin Veterans Memorial Auditorium, bringing in recording equipment, and recording an album there without an audience. At this, Lesh relented, and the band cut In the Dark, the Dead's first million-selling album, in 1987. After Garcia's passing, the political climate in the GDP boardroom was not so harmonious. In the ongoing debate over Bandwagon, which Lesh had inexplicably started to back away from, the other members finally had enough of Lesh's uncompromising positions. They reluctantly passed a motion placing the board under majority rule, essentially stripping Lesh of his cherished veto power. It only served to strengthen Lesh's resolve. Lesh broke with the other band members openly after the vote. He abruptly stopped attending board meetings. He spoke only infrequently to the other band members, which left him ill-informed on details of projects. No one, not even other band members, knew the scope of Lesh's alienation since his transplant. The other members had waited for Lesh's recovery from surgery to plan a summer tour with the other ones. Lesh held back, giving excuses for not making a commitment, only to decide instead to test drive Phil and friends out of town with the 8 dates on Summer Sessions 99. By the time he informed his bandmates of his plans, it was too late for them to mount tours of their own, leaving them without a tour or income for the summer. Lesh posted a statement on the Dead's webpage. "I enjoyed playing with each and every musician in the other ones last year, but the tour was extremely stressful due to business and creative differences. I honored my commitment and made no promises for future shows. After my surgery, I was approached about doing another tour, but it became clear that the same unresolved issues were still haunting us." At least, that was true for him. The other members were caught off guard by Lesh's announcement of the divorce. He was asserting his dominance and abandoning even the pretext of all for one. He drew a line in the sand. Everyone was more interested in doing their own thing, Lesh told the Denver Post. So we decided to give it a rest. And he did. Undaunted, when plans for any other one's tour evaporated, Mickey Hart moved ahead. His latest version of his solo group, Planet Drum, was built around the talented Latin musician Rebecca Mauleon, and everything was splashed in Caribbean and African flavors and rhythms. Mark Caron played guitar. Hart released a new Planet Drum album, Spirit into Sound. A book of quotations about rhythm and percussion with the same title was about to be published, his third book as an author. Hart had also been named that May to the Board of Trustees of the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center. Hart liked to stay busy. He took his new large band on a brief August tour that included a not-so-sentimental stop at Woodstock 99, where Hart and John Entwistle of The Who were the only two veterans of the historic 1969 festival. As Phil and friends played their monthly concerts and built up steam in Deadhead circles, Weir, for the first time since Garcia's death 3 years earlier, retreated from constant touring to the relative obscurity of the recording studio. All year, Weir had been largely buried in the studio with Rat Dog, playing just a handful of dates, and many of those with only bassist Wasserman and drummer Lane. The recording sessions for the debut Rat Dog album dragged endlessly, as the band and engineers struggled to learn digital recording, moving from pre-production in Weir's home studio to Belmarin Keys. Mark Caron joined the band after the Other Ones tour, so Rat Dog finally had a lead guitar. Both Weir's dead collaborator and childhood friend, John Perry Barlow, and Robert Hunter contributed lyrics, and Weir spent countless hours fiddling with the recordings. He was also drinking heavily again. Weir felt challenged by Lesh, whose Phil and friends had abandoned Weir after he had played every show with Lesh's band the first year of its existence. Lost at first, a competitive spirit soon stirred in his head. He needed to develop a program of his own. Weir thought he could take the advantage by producing a new album of original songs, forging ahead with fresh creative ideas, extending his band's identity, and making a serious effort at establishing Rat Dog as a recording act. While the internet was only months away from punching a hole in the record business's bucket, devoting the time to make a credible Rat Dog album made a certain strategic sense. And, of all things, he was starting a family. On July 15th, he and Natasha were married by a Buddhist minister in the street in front of their house. The 51-year-old groom wore a Scottish kilt, and the bride, 20 years younger, was dressed in an antique white gown. She held their year-old daughter, Monet, in her arms through most of the ceremony. John Perry Barlow acted as best man. Bandmates Hart and Lesh were among the 40 or so guests. "Three words we thought we'd never hear," said Lesh. "Bob Weir wedding." The party repaired to the Mill Valley Outdoors Art Club. The newlyweds arrived by horse-drawn carriage to dance to the music of the Dave Ellis Quartet, led by the Rat Dog saxophonist, who managed a jazzy version of Terrapin Station for the occasion. Ellis was now well beyond his youthful jazz snobbery. Chapter 8. Phelan. Steve Parrish wasn't sure about going back on the road. When he tried to beg off going out with Phil and friends, Lesh would have nothing of it. "This is your life," he told Parrish. "This is what you do. You'll be fine." It wasn't that he didn't like Lesh. Parrish liked Lesh plenty. But Parrish secretly sensed he was still traumatized from the sudden end of the dead. No roadie in rock had ever been more loyal than Parrish was to Garcia. He was like a soldier with shell shock being sent back to the front, although Parrish, he-man that he was, banished any doubts and pressed forward. Lesh was on a roll. 3 weeks before setting sail on his band's first serious out-of-town tour opening for Bob Dylan, Lesh wanted to warm up with some October shows by fill-in friends at the Warfield. For these, Lesh brought out a pair of musicians from a Grateful Dead tribute band that operated largely in and around New York City called the Zen Tricksters, guitarist Jeff Mattson and keyboardist Rob Baracco. The Tricksters had been playing Dead covers since starting out around Long Island in 1978, and, since Garcia's death, had become a hugely popular attraction in Deadhead circles. Lesh didn't know any of this when the two Tricksters showed up in Marin County to rehearse. In his studies of Deadhead culture, Lesh had been made aware of the tribute bands for the first time, and they bothered him. "They're making a living off our music," he often said. Around that time, one of his associates slipped him a CD of the Tricksters doing their own original material. Lesh was impressed with how well they jammed in the studio, although he was unaware of their basic premise. They sounded strangely familiar to Lesh's ears. He invited the two soloists to play with him at the Warfield, without knowing that the Tricksters were actually one of the best and longest-running Dead tribute bands. During the first rehearsal, Lesh was surprised at how well the two musicians knew the material. Lesh opened the first of those Warfield shows with a 22-minute version of Van Halen's Jump. This didn't come as a complete surprise to Baracco and Mattson, who were driving around that week in an extra car of Lesh's and saw the Van Halen cassette lying on the seat, figuring it was something his young boys liked. Lesh was in a highly experimental mood that weekend. He opened the next night with Miles Davis's Milestones, not exactly a staple of Deadhead repertoire, and did a 15-minute version of John Coltrane's My Favorite Things during the second set opening night. Lesh was trying to expand the horizons. Kamok played on all the shows. Since the transplant, he had become Lesh's most trusted musical intimate. Kamok was both an easygoing, genial presence backstage and a valuable, inventive player, a highly original guitarist who could effortlessly evoke a wide range of diverse styles, from Jerry Garcia to John Abercrombie. He could play pristine, almost miniaturist arabesques, or go boldly, noisily into the zone. He practiced guitar 8 to 10 hours a day. He could be commonly seen strolling around backstage, guitar slung over his shoulder, running scales. He had played every Phil and Friend show since Lesh came back. Growing up in western Pennsylvania, Kamok had never been especially keen on the Dead. He was more of an Allman Brothers fan. But the other guys in his band at the time were such Deadheads, they decided to move to Marin County, and Kamok went with them. Almost from his first days in California, he was compared to Garcia, especially after he hooked up with former Dead members Keith and Donna Godshow and began playing in their Heart of Gold band in 1980. After Garcia gave the Guitar magazine that quote about Kamok being his favorite unknown guitar player, Kamok knew it was a compliment, but he also felt it was something like a piece of gum stuck to the sole of his shoe. He deliberately began to avoid comparisons, changing equipment, not playing certain songs, finding other voices for his solos, but the association never went away. He was well known in Dead circles, if nowhere else. He played briefly with Missing Man Formation, keyboardist Vince Welnick's band, after Welnick's departure from Rat Dog. Phil and friends were headed out for a month in October, beginning with a 3-show weekend at the Denver Fillmore before hitting the road as opening act on 17 dates with Dylan through the Midwest and East Coast. To round out his little rhythm section of Molo and Kamok and himself, Lesh invited guitarist Paul Barrere and keyboardist Billy Payne from the fabled Los Angeles rock band Little Feat. Even with extensive rehearsals in Marin, there was too much material for the Little Feat fellows to learn, which meant they were taking music stands on stage and reading sheet music while they played for the first time in their lives. The weekend in Denver was stressful for Steve Parrish and his partner Ramrod. They hadn't been out on the road in the recent past, and neither cared to make excuses for how the strain affected them. Parrish was snapping at other crew members, surely to one and all, including the Leshes. Jill Lesh was now officially acting as manager, and she had opinions on a wide range of production issues, going so far as to include how the equipment should be stowed and unloaded. Parrish and Ramrod looked at Jill Lesh and didn't see a manager. They saw a former waitress who once served them breakfast, but married their boss and now lorded over them, making what they considered uninformed decisions about key touring issues, from routing to what was acceptable attire on stage. She banished headbands and other forms of hippie wear. Parrish fumed that Garcia never wore anything for anyone else's pleasure. He didn't bother to control his temper. At the end of the three-night run in Denver, the Leshes presented both with airplane tickets home. Kamak spotted the pair lingering backstage with the tickets in their hands. He had spent most of his time with the crew, where he felt more at home. Parrish was humiliated because he knew he had brought this on himself, but he was also angry. He wanted to cause some trouble. "Are you still making $500 a week?" he asked Kamak. "Jerry would have paid you $5,000. Go in there and ask what's up with the money." Kamak had been growing increasingly uncomfortable with the atmosphere surrounding the Enterprise. He felt himself being subjected to loyalty tests and subtle inquisitions, and Kamak had no taste for politics. He was there for the music. He had been questioning Jill Lesh, making more and more decisions that weren't necessarily hers to make, stepping outside of established protocols, but sending Parrish and Ramrod home seemed like a last straw to the guitar monk. He decided to address his issues with the Leshes, and, egged on by Parrish, went to their dressing room. It did not go well. Jill Lesh went into a tirade. After listening to her rant about his lack of respect and loyalty, he left their dressing room. Lesh, who was watching TV, closed the door behind him. Minutes later, Jill Lesh charged into the crew food buffet, still yelling at Kamak, who was standing in the stairwell. She confronted him, enraged, and threw crumpled dollar bills into his shocked face. "You want money?" she said. Kamak took his gear off the truck, slept with it locked in his room, got up the next day, rented a truck, and drove back to California. A few days later, he left a cryptic post on his website. "Dear friends and family, we regret to announce that Steve Kamak has chosen to flee the Bob Dylan / Phil Lesh tour. We apologize for any inconvenience, pray for your forgiveness, and look forward to your continued support. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more." Signed, running and shooting behind him as fast as he can, Steve Kamak. While most had little difficulty understanding the reference to the Dylan song, "He hands you a nickel, he hands you a dime, he asks if you're having a good time," the running and shooting line was more obscure. When he first contemplated going to work with the guys in The Other Ones, he had consulted Robert Hunter, longtime lyricist for The Grateful Dead, who knew Kamak from his songwriting for Kamak's band, Zero. "Run," Hunter had told Kamak, "and keep running and shooting behind you as fast as you can." When Parrish and Ramrod returned to Belmarin Keys, they held a festive barbecue to celebrate their firing. A sign on one of the vans in the lot read, "Welcome Home." They fired up the Weber outside the eyesore production trailer that served as their office in the parking lot and entertained the crew and staff. Mickey Hart, who was working in the studio, joined the celebration. Peter McQuaid couldn't help but notice the encroaching rivalry, a fierce divide emerging. There was an us-against-them mentality breaking out beyond the boardroom, he thought. On the road, the Leshes scrambled to get guitarist Derek Trucks to fly in and join the tour, although he missed the next three dates, and Lesh, Molo, and the two Little Feet guys with their music stands had to fend for themselves. Trucks was the 20-year-old nephew of the Allman Brothers drummer, who played a lot of hot Duane Allman licks. The next night, the revolving cast again rotated. The Little Feat guys were gone, replaced by guitarist Warren Haynes and keyboardist Rob Baracco of the Zen Tricksters and the October Warfield Run. Jefferson Airplane lead guitarist Jorma Kaukonen also joined the band for the final few dates. Dylan was a remote presence on the tour. His band would do the sound check without him. His RV would arrive backstage shortly before showtime. He would emerge, walk straight to the stage, play his show, and leave without any further interaction. Dylan was no stranger to borrowing the Dead's audience. In 1987, when he was at a low ebb creatively and commercially, he joined forces with the Dead as his backup band to make a triumphant summer tour of packed football stadiums he could have never even half filled on his own. Dylan was extremely fond of Jerry Garcia and attended the funeral. He had genuine respect for the Grateful Dead. On the road with the untried Phil and friends, from the first night, it was clear that the audience was packed with Deadheads. The opening act was pulling its weight at the box office. By the end of the tour, Dylan was calling out Lesh to play bass on a Dead tune like Alabama Getaway. That was as much jamming as Dylan was going to do. The same day Lesh started the Dylan tour, Ratdog hit the road until December, a killer 30-date tour headlining largely 3,000-seat theaters and adding more Dead songs to the set almost every night. The battle of the bands was underway on the road. Back home, behind the scenes, the antagonism between the band members was boiling up to a horrifying peak as Lesh chose to publicly break with the other three over the Bandwagon project, one of the most promising possibilities the Dead ever contemplated. McNamee was getting ready to poise the Dead at the forefront of the internet explosion. Plans called for participation to be spread throughout the Dead organization, which would have meant more than saving jobs. It would have been an investment they all shared. As venture capitalists met with the band to investigate ways of financing the ambitious undertaking, Lesh got cold feet. He completely ignored, or chose to forget, McNamee's stated insistence on not putting the vault on the table. He lashed out at McNamee and his bandmates in a carefully prepared statement released to the press in December 1999. The Grateful Dead have never accepted corporate sponsorship or venture capital money, and I remain unalterably opposed to any deal that would lease, license, or otherwise collateralize the music in the vault, Lesh wrote. The Grateful Dead have a history of mismanagement and bad business decisions, and I fear that this current plan will become the crown jewel in that collection. Openly breaking with his band members raised their conflict to a new level of hostility and violated their brotherhood in a new and particularly traumatic way. Lesh had always strictly observed the band's code of silence, even when called to testify in the widow's lawsuit, and for him to take his internal disagreements into the open was evidence of how the principles at the core of the Dead's life for all these years, the basic agreement by which the members lived and worked, had broken down. "This situation is very sad for me on many levels," his statement concluded. "It has brought me to the realization that the Grateful Dead is now only a corporation with whose directors I no longer share a common vision." It was the opening public salvo in a simmering feud that had been going on undercover for more than a year. Lesh's outburst caused such a stir among the fans that the other three members felt obligated to post a statement to the Deadheads on the band's website signed by Weir, Hart, and Kreutzmann. "There has never been, nor will there ever be, any discussion of selling our vault, our music, our name, our legacy. Not to Microsoft, not to anyone. The vault is part of our heart and soul. And yours. We're taking steps to preserve it for all time. We have an opportunity to take the lead as music and the internet converge. Opportunities like this come along very, very rarely." But the full depth of the acrimony behind the scenes only broke into public view when Mickey Hart gave an unfiltered interview shortly thereafter. Nobody's at war with Phil, Hart said. He's just out of the loop. He just hasn't paid attention for years. He's just in the Phil zone. God save him. Nobody pays much attention to him. He's sort of on the outside. He's of no consequence, really. The Grateful Dead has always worked as a democracy, Hart continued. Phil's the odd man out. So he took his marbles and split, like a little boy would. That's his prerogative. God bless him. I wish him well. But believe me, we don't miss him. We're having a great time without him. It couldn't be better. If someone doesn't want to play with you, you don't play with them. We have no fight with him. He's sort of at odds with himself. I think that liver transplant didn't go so well. He might have gotten the liver of a jerk. Hart quickly apologized. Apart from the politically incorrect remark about the organ donor, his comments may have been cold, but they accurately reflected the sentiments of Lesh's bandmates at the time. They were all but entirely alienated. Lesh had concentrated exclusively on his Phil and Friends rehearsals and shows and was entirely absent from company meetings. Now he was even out of social contact with the other members. The Terrapin Station project he had once championed had stalled. Kumsky had located an Orange County-based real estate development firm ready to partner. A piece of property had been purchased in mid-1998 in downtown San Francisco, and the architects made some minor adjustments to their existing plans, but Kumsky couldn't get the band to budge. They seemed distracted with their infighting. Frustrated, he gave up trying to get their attention. Phil and Friends was consuming a tremendous amount of Lesh's time. At the end of the Dylan tour, Lesh had played 43 shows with 36 different musicians. Few of them were that well acquainted with Dead music, which can be complex and challenging and comes with a giant songbook. After spending his life playing the same music with people who all knew the music intimately, Lesh found himself devoting endless hours rehearsing other musicians. After running through 5 guitarists on the Dylan tour, his next guitarist was yet another unlikely but inspired choice, blues guitarist Robin Ford. Ford grew up in remote Ukiah, California. As a teenager, he started a blues band with his brothers and backed harmonica ace Charlie Musselwhite. At 23, Ford joined the band behind George Harrison on his 1974 U.S. tour, led by saxophonist Tom Scott. He worked with Joni Mitchell and Miles Davis over the course of his long career and made a series of outstanding blues and R&B solo albums. But Lesh had never heard of him when drummer Molo brought up his name. Ford flew up to Marin from his home in Southern California and spent 3 days jamming with the band. He knew nothing about Grateful Dead music, and the job didn't seem to call on his expertise in blues. He knew it wasn't a jazz gig, but he could jam. He loved playing with Molo, and found the guitar-oriented music set him free in ways he couldn't have imagined. Ford was astonished at how much fun he had. He told Lesh he was down with whatever he had in mind. What Lesh had in mind was matching Ford as the surprise guitarist with the two Little Feet guys at his 60th birthday Phil and Friends benefit concert for his Unbroken Chain Foundation in March 2000 at the Henry J. Kaiser Auditorium in Oakland, a particularly sentimental site for Deadheads. Next to Lake Merritt in downtown Oakland, the parking lot and adjacent park were filled once again with the camp followers and itinerant hippies who thronged the place on many grand New Year's Eves past when the Grateful Dead played. It had always been one of the favorite settings for Dead shows, one of the original parking lots. The funky old hall was the scene of some indelible Dead moments, like the year the band rang in the new one with Etta James and the Tower of Power horn section singing In the Midnight Hour. In the year since his return to action, Lesh had clearly established the Phil and Friends concert with the Deadheads and grabbed the banner with his fan-friendly repertoire, heavy emphasis on jamming, and a rotating cast of guest musicians. Rumors had been flying among the dead circles, where rumors fly easily, about what guests Phil and friends would include on this auspicious occasion, his return to Oakland and the first show of the new century. Bob Dylan, Bob Weir, Trey Anastasio. They knew Lesh always kept the Phil and Friends lineup secret until the curtain went up. The Deadheads went along with the game. The parking lot filled up days before the show. The circus was back in town. At age 60, every man takes stock of his life. It cannot be avoided. It is a milestone of indisputable proportions, the gateway to old age and the end of youth. 1 year from a drastic, life-saving surgery, at the absolute peak of his professional career, for the first time in his life, leading his own band that, in less than 2 years, had grown in popularity to the point where he could now attract crowds that rivaled those drawn by the Dead themselves during the late 70s and early 80s, Phil Lesh had good reason to feel immense pride and deep satisfaction. At the Kaiser, he was returning to celebrate at the scene of greater glories. He had psychedelic poster artist Stanley Mouse, co-creator of the Skull and Roses logo, and so much more Dead emblemology, make a brilliant poster for the concert, showing Lesh playing bass astride a giant dragon. He took the stage playing guitar with Mike Gordon of Phish on bass for the first two numbers, before settling into his customary role on the bass. Guitarists Ford and Barrere lit the place on fire. Pianist Payne feeding the flames with his piercing, flickering solos, making for what was undoubtedly the most raucous and least Grateful Dead-like Phil and Friends yet. After the concert, for an additional $150, VIPs could attend a reception in the auditorium's upstairs ballroom, where they nibbled expensive desserts and listened to a string quartet play, while a bluegrass fiddler sat atop a large wrapped gift box and sang Box of Rain. Wavy Gravy, the clown prince of Woodstock, dressed as Ludwig van Beethoven, sang Happy Birthday to the birthday boy, who was accepting his well-wishers while seated on a king's throne on the stage, as regal as a king without actually wearing a crown. "Don't eat the brown strudel," warned Gravy. Chapter 9. Soul Battle. While their adoring public imagined only a golden circle of love inside the band, it was, in reality, a bitter civil war. They had been able to orbit somewhat peacefully around Garcia, but they always knew peace was tenuous among a group of such dedicated contrarians. After a press conference backstage at UC Berkeley's Greek Theater, where the Dead were celebrating the band's 20th anniversary in 1985, Phil Lesh was buttonholed by a reporter and asked what he thought was the main reason the band lasted so long. Lesh assumed a mock contemplative pose, hand on chin. "I think we're all waiting for a chance to get even," he said. He wasn't entirely joking. Since Garcia died, the dynamics among the guys had changed so many times that nobody knew what to expect any longer. Without Garcia, nobody could find a lasting equilibrium under which the survivors could operate. In those dark days, out of grief and confusion, the band let their basic product lapse. They almost deliberately dismantled the brand, making some precipitous, dubious business decisions that would hamper them for years. Retiring the name alone was a completely unnecessary shot in the foot that left the band limping. There was other self-sabotage as well. In the midst of their own indecision and separate directions, they confused the public, undermined their connection with the most loyal fan base of any rock band, and did everything they could to destroy their standing in the marketplace. Even when the surviving members could finally agree to play music together again, 3 years after Garcia's death, they still couldn't face using the band's name and came up with the Other Ones dodge. Nor could they solve the guitar issue. Without Garcia around to mediate, the four had little in common other than their fates as members of the Grateful Dead. Even Hart and Kreutzmann, the Drum Brothers, could be contemptuous of each other, as close as they were from all the years of sharing rhythm, psychedelics, and everything else. College graduate Lesh likely looked down on all three as his intellectual inferiors. Weir could be extraordinarily instinctual or unbelievably goofy, but he was never entirely grounded. Plus, he had a tendency to drink, sometimes mixing booze with pharmaceuticals, which could make communication difficult. Cast adrift together, it had become difficult for them to find common purpose, unified direction, or even a consistently congenial relationship. Lesh had a long list of beefs with his bandmates, extending back to rejecting his wife for the Rex Foundation board. Most recently, he had taken up arms against Bandwagon with a fury. He raged against McNamee and the suits in Silicon Valley, accused McQuaid of taking bribes from bankers, and told interviewers the other band members wanted to sell the vault, which was never under consideration. A serious financing proposal was in negotiation, and McNamee was reaching out to other acts, from the Dave Matthews Band to Pearl Jam to U2, about joining forces with the Dead on the internet. But Lesh's early enthusiasm for the project had turned to an outright antagonism that no one understood, especially given he was no longer keeping abreast of developments or attending any meetings since recovering from the liver transplant. As Lesh's understanding of the Dead culture grew from his experiences in Phil and Friends, both with other musicians and the audience, he took bold, definite steps to capture the banner that the others left where it fell when Garcia died. With Rat Dog, Weir had gone looking to find himself. Mickey Hart was really an activist musicologist whose work was more conceptual art than anything else. With Phil and Friends, Lesh waved the flag and rallied the troops. He was willing to super serve his core audience, and they responded wildly. Hungry for the Dead-like experience Phil and Friends provided, an eager minority of Deadheads embraced the band and Lesh's repertory concept, which kind of solved the guitar problem, with breathtaking speed. Following the smashing success on the Dylan tour, Phil and Friends were booked into multiple nights in April 2000 at Big City East Coast Theaters, where Lesh sold out 6 shows at New York City's Beacon Theater, 4 nights at Boston's Orpheum Theater, and 3 nights at the Tower Theater in Philadelphia. He was suddenly a certified attraction. However close they had been before, since the transplant, Phil and Jill Lesh were welded together into one. To others who knew her as the scrupulous, caring mother and calmly supported wife on Dead tours, her transformation into fierce music business administrator and Phil Lesh guard dog came as a surprise. Her steely drive and cold ambition were a rarity in Dead circles, where such values were never considered cool. The life or death ordeal of Lesh's liver transplant, not to mention Jill's thyroid cancer surgery, undoubtedly fused their intimacy. Indeed, nobody doubted that the Leshes spoke as one person. Lesh had frequently sulked in the background during his time with the Grateful Dead, and for years had quietly nurtured his resentments against his bandmates. He did not want to suffer fools any longer. After his transplant, he would not. In the collapse of the long-standing leadership in the Dead world that followed Garcia's death, Lesh had finally navigated himself into a position of power. His days of standing in the corner were over. He clearly decided to take over as master of the legacy, and his wife was determined for him to have it. Lesh no doubt thought, who else could it be? He could well have determined that it couldn't be benighted Bobby Weir, drunken, dysfunctional, dreamy, and fumbling. Or hard-headed Mickey Hart, the pseudo-intellectual drummer who was losing his hearing and couldn't keep time. Brutish Billy Kreutzmann, who was busy picking pineapples and dropping acid in Hawaii? No. Lesh alone was suited to take the lead. Only he could restore the soul of the Grateful Dead. Lesh had largely cut off his contact with the other band members when he called a meeting at his house. It was a summons, really. Weir and Hart left after a business meeting at Belmarin Keys with Peter McQuaid. Phil and Jill sat together on their couch, holding hands, fingers intertwined. While Phil stayed largely quiet, Jill explained the New World Order to her astonished guests. She began by telling them it was clear that she and Phil now were the protectors of the spirit of the Grateful Dead. The Leshes had become the true champions of the band's legacy. There was no longer any need on their part for further association with the rest of the band. Phil would carry the banner. They would take it from here. Caught up in her fervor, she summarized with a stunning pronouncement. She told the other lifelong members of the original band, "You don't know anything about the Grateful Dead." Bob Weir exploded off the piano stool where he had been sitting. He stood up and shouted. "Wait a minute," he said. "How many Grateful Dead shows have you played?" Usually easygoing and slow-talking, Weir was furious. He had been holding back his anger and resentments toward Lesh for some time. Years, actually. Lesh had always been a stumbling block, a sarcastic older brother figure who had not been averse to slapping around teenage Weir in the band's earliest days. If the emergence of Phil and Friends had sparked some competitive impulses with Weir, prodding him into adding a lead guitarist and more Dead songs to Rat Dog, he had been able to largely ignore Lesh's complaints, or at least write them off as the understandable irritability of someone going through a major health crisis. But this pronouncement from Jill Lesh was something he could no longer ignore. This was a battle for the soul of the Grateful Dead. Band members' wives did not dictate band policy. Jill had not even come along until the band had been through two of the most tumultuous, creative, and momentous decades of their career. The Dead have long memories. Keyboardist Brent Myland played in the band for more than 10 years and was still the new guy. For Jill Lesh, the waitress his bandmate married, to lay claim to the mantle of all that Weir had struggled to achieve, the tens of thousands of miles he traveled, the thousands of gigs he played, the blood, sweat, and tears spilled over many long years, was simply not acceptable. He wrote many of the Dead's greatest songs, and sang even more. Lesh wrote exactly one of the band's great songs, and if Weir had sung it instead of Lesh, Box of Rain would be one of the best-remembered Dead songs ever. Listening to Jill's crazy rant made him sick to his stomach. Even more unacceptable was his bandmate, sitting beside this upstart, nodding his tacit approval. The meeting ended quickly and badly. A torrent of mean and angry emails followed, Weir blasting the Leshes in long, passionate letters, even going so far as to blame Jill's thyroid medication for creating a personality disorder. War had broken out into the open. In June, Lesh headed out on a second Phil and Friends tour with Bob Dylan, this time as co-headliner. The plan called for each act to alternate closing, but after watching Lesh close the first show in Portland to an audience teeming with Deadheads, Dylan decided he would rather take the opening slot. The Deadheads turned out in droves to see Phil and Friends, and Dylan didn't mind being the opening act. He could get back to the hotel earlier. On the April tour of East Coast Theaters, Lesh had taken guitarists Jimmy Herring of Dead cover band Jazz is Dead and Jeff Pivar, whom he met sitting in with David Crosby. For the summer tour, he brought back blues slinger Robin Ford and the Little Feet guys, guitarist Paul Barrere and keyboardist Billy Payne, who showed up exhausted, coming off 8 straight weeks on the road with the Feet. Billy Kreutzmann had moved back to Marin County. He had married again, and his new wife, his fourth, was tired of living in Hawaii. He bought a house in Ross, a few miles west of San Rafael. Even from a long distance, Kreutzmann had been dismissive of Lesh's complaints and supportive of Weir and Hart's perspective. He had made a show of strength appearance at the 1999 New Year's Eve show by Rat Dog and the Mickey Hart Band at the Warfield Theater, and the GDP Christmas party the night before at the Fillmore, before moving back to town. He sat in with both bands, all three bandmates playing together at midnight at the Warfield, while Phil and friends sat idle that New Year's. It was summer 2000, after he had bought the house in Ross, that Kreutzmann found himself at the Belmarin Keys rehearsal hall. The latest edition of The Other Ones had assembled to begin rehearsals and start seeking a second drummer to play a summer tour, since Molo would be going out with Phil and friends. Kreutzmann took the empty drum chair next to Hart on a lark for one song. Instead of Lesch, the band had drafted Alfonso Johnson of jazz fusion greats Weather Report, although more importantly, since 1998, bassist with Jazz is Dead. Jazz is Dead was a high-concept instrumental act put together by a booking agent around Dixie Dregs keyboardist T. Lavitz and Miles Davis drummer Billy Cobham. Jimmy Herring was the band's original guitarist. The band played jazz-inclined interpretations from the Grateful Dead songbook, yet another example of how musicians were approaching the Dead as repertoire. Alfonso Johnson knew how to walk the thin line between playing the root at the bottom end and keeping the flexibility for improvisation. Also, unlike Lesch, he did not mind coming down on the one. Drummers loved him, if only for that. Sometimes, Hart thought Lesch would be buzzing like a bee around the bottom, never sure where to land. Sometimes, if Lesch was in a particularly foul mood, he might fool with the drummers purposefully, coming down on the 16th note after the beat just to throw off the groove. One song was all it took Kreutzmann to decide whatever these guys were doing, he wanted in. He said so. "The original drummer?" said Johnson. "Oh, yeah, let's take him." Hart was juiced anyway. He had just returned from the Democratic National Convention, where he had pounded tom-toms on stage while his friend Al Gore was nominated for president. Hart and Weir had played a few big-ticket fundraisers in Silicon Valley for the campaign backed by Robert McNamee's band, the Flying Other Brothers. But Hart had come to know the vice president and his wife, Tipper, over the course of the Clinton administration. Tipper was not only a drummer, but a big deadhead. She sat in on congas with the band at venture capitalist billionaire John Doerr's home. Al Gore and Hart had spent considerable personal time together, and offstage and at ease, Gore was an entirely different person than the stiff public face. They became friends. Hart's frenetic energy could be contagious to many. He was a late-life sailing partner of television newsman Walter Cronkite. The federal government was filled with deadheads. President Clinton had been seen wearing Jerry Garcia ties. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont had been a fan for years. But Wall Street firms were also stacked with deadheads. This was not as surprising as it may seem. Not all deadheads were hippies. During the 80s, East Coast prep schools were a hotbed of dead tape traders, and the culture incubated among the nascent upper class. Like they say, politics makes strange bedfellows. Hart came back from the Los Angeles convention having hobnobbed with Paul pals like Senator Harry Reid, the Mormon lawmaker from Nevada, whom Hart came to know through his work with the Library of Congress. Mickey Hart parlayed his political enthusiasms into a board seat of the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center, where he was deeply involved in sound preservation. Rooting around the archives, Hart found a 1938 recording by fiddler Al Gore Sr., the vice president's father, and presented Gore Jr. with a copy. He and Weir appeared in April at a Library of Congress bicentennial concert, also featuring Pete Seeger, Tito Puente, and others. He also joined the board of the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function to further pursue his studies of the seat of music in the brain. His wife, Carol Hart, was appointed to the State Parks and Recreation Commission in March after having been recommended for the job by Vice President Gore. Hart spent all May on tour with his new Mickey Hart band, featuring former Dead keyboardist Vince Welnick, whose missing man formation had fallen apart and who was glad to have the opportunity to be back in the fold. He showed up with fresh vigor for The Other Ones, pumped to be reunited with Kreutzmann, his partner in rhythm since 1967. With Johnson replacing Lesch on bass, the bottom end was contoured to a more conventional approach, But Kreutzmann and Hart combined for a signature drum sound that instantly spelled Grateful Dead. Saxophonist Dave Ellis was gone. He left Rat Dog the previous December, a victim of clinical depression and too much road. They worked up a couple more of Hornsby's numbers, The Way It Is, The Valley Road, and kept the new Robert Hunter songs from the previous tour. Rehearsals were mainly devoted to tightening up the new rhythm section on the existing repertoire. "It's basically a new band, but I have the benefit of knowing the songs," said Kreutzmann. The debate about how much rehearsal is good before it robs the band of spontaneity has been going on as long as there has been a Grateful Dead. During the band's 1975 hiatus, they never rehearsed, and the few gigs they did play were highly satisfactory to band and audience alike, evidence invariably cited in almost all future arguments against too much rehearsal. Hart picked up the refrain with Hornsby, explaining he didn't want the songs too tight. "No," Hornsby said. "We want to get them as tight as possible and take off from there." "I just don't want all those guitar players tripping over each other," said Hart. 101 strings, said Hornsby, laughing. "My worst nightmare," said Hart. "At least there's no saxophone." That August, this time, the tour was greeted with enthusiasm from the start by the Deadheads, who thronged the sheds the band played. They occasionally brought out opening act Ziggy Marley, Bob's son, to sing one of his father's songs like Stir It Up or I Shot the Sheriff. Hart added an electric kalimba to his arsenal during the nightly drum solos. If the response to the shows lacked the surprise element that the previous Other Ones tour supplied, the shows sold out and the band was greeted like conquering heroes. For his fall tour, Lesh brought together a Fill-In Friends configuration that would prove more enduring than other additions. Bringing back Molo on drums and Baracco on keys, he added guitarists Jimmy Herring, who had been playing with the Allman Brothers since his East Coast tour with Fill-In Friends ended in April, and Warren Haynes, another Allman Brothers guitarist who had been playing on and off with Fill-In Friends since early 1999. This lineup, which fans would come to call the Q for quintet, started life with an October sweep through multiple nights in East Coast theaters that included a stunning 7 sold-out shows at New York's Beacon Theater, home turf in New York for the Allmans since 1989. By comparison, the Rat Dog fall tour started in the West and moved through clubs and single nights in theaters. Rat Dog came through Chicago to play one night at the Riviera Theater in November, 2 weeks after Fill-In Friends did 4 sold-out shows in the hall. After receiving word from the Lesh camp that he would be spending New Year's Eve in Florida, the Other Ones announced an ambitious New Year's Eve concert at the 16,000-seat Oakland Coliseum Arena, only to have the rug pulled out from under them when Lesh suddenly switched plans and booked a Fill-In Friends show for New Year's Eve down the freeway a few exits at the Henry J. Kaiser Auditorium in Oakland, a sentimental favorite with Deadheads. This was an open act of warfare. He cut down the audience for the Other Ones by half, while Fill-In Friends sold out the 8,000-seat HJK. It was a mean, deliberate power play by Lesh. By planting his flag a mere 5 miles from his erstwhile bandmates the same night, he was making a statement. He was also taking the backstage battle into the public arena, making their fans take sides on the Deadheads' special night. With the Phil people packed into the Kaiser and the Other Ones crowd rambling around the half-empty, antiseptic basketball arena, the victory was all Lesh's, even if he made the Deadheads choose, like children of a divorced couple, whether to spend the holidays with mom or dad. Chapter 10. Garcia's Guitars. Doug Long became an attorney somewhat late in life. After he started his practice in the remote Central Valley town of Visalia, he phoned his ex-wife, a lifelong attorney, in Sonoma to tell her he had joined her ranks. A few days later, she called back. "Your old friend Doug Irwin is in trouble, and I don't have time for this," she said. Since you are just starting out, maybe you do. When Long lived in Sonoma, he came to know Irwin, a luthier, guitar maker, with a shop in downtown Sonoma. Long was in public relations at the time, but played in bands and commissioned Irwin to build a guitar for him around the same time Irwin was building a guitar for Jerry Garcia that would be called Tiger. Some leftover pieces of wood from Tiger found their way onto Long's Irwin guitar. Jerry Garcia had walked into Doug Irwin's studio one day in 1972. He paid $750 for a guitar Irwin had in the window and asked Irwin to build him a second guitar. Garcia and Mountain Girl returned with a pile of cash, and Irwin and his assistant went to work on a guitar they called in the shop the Garcia. When he delivered the instrument in May 1973, it was named Wolf. Garcia was so pleased with the guitar, Irwin went to work on another guitar for him. The next guitar, Tiger, took 6 years for Irwin to make. Altogether, Irwin would build 5 guitars for Garcia. Long found Irwin in jail on an assault charge. In 1997, Irwin had suffered severe brain damage when he was struck by a hit-and-run driver while riding his bicycle. The brain damage imposed severe personality changes on Irwin, made him subject to sudden, irrational mood shifts and angry outbursts. He had been arrested after a confrontation with another motorist while on his bike had gotten out of hand. Long went and got him out of jail. Irwin, he soon discovered, was not doing well. He was living under a bridge. His shop had been closed, and his tools were in storage. Irwin was mentally ill and only marginally able to care for himself. He was no longer capable of running his own business. Then he told Long the story about how the Grateful Dead wouldn't let him have the guitars Jerry Garcia left him in his will. This was no hallucination. When Irwin consulted the will, sure enough, there it was. Not only was it the first bequest in the will, above the gifts to family members, but it was the only such mention in the entire document of anyone outside Garcia's family. Long called the Dead office and reached Cameron Sears, who told Irwin he was the 6th or 7th lawyer to be heard from. "But I'm the lawyer who is going to sue you," Long said. GDP counsel Hal Kant had long cautioned the GDP management about the guitars in Garcia's will. Kant was certain the guitars had been paid for with corporate funds and, consequently, belonged to the company. The band members feared that Irwin was going to turn around and sell the guitars to the highest bidder, and that their bandmates' precious instruments would disappear from public view. They knew he couldn't resist the money. Of course, Terrapin Station, officially on hold, was still in their minds, but they realized they needed to take action to counter looming public relations problems. In February, mindful of Irwin's new legal representative and the gathering storm, GDP contacted the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland and offered to loan them 5 of Garcia's guitars. They did not offer Wolf because they were no longer certain the band held title to that guitar and turned it over to the Garcia estate. The Dead made one Dead-like proviso. The guitars must be displayed where people do not have to pay an admission price to see them. In a minute, the guitars were whisked to Cleveland and placed on display in the lobby. In March 2001, Attorney Long filed Irwin's suit against Grateful Dead Productions in Marin County Superior Court. On March 27th, Weir, Hart, and Kreutzmann, with Lesh notable by his absence, signed a defensive 1,300-word post on the band's website stating in detail the band's case and refuting some of the public statements by Irwin and his attorney. During the time that GDP was a partnership, the statement read in part, "And then, later, when it became a corporation, we as a group always bought and maintained the instruments used by the band on stage and in recording. We did this purposely. Because all the stage instruments were bought and maintained in the same way, we thought we had avoided any arguments over who owned what. We all owned it all. All for one and one for all." The letter to the Deadheads acknowledged the fans' stake in the debate. Only the members of the Grateful Dead would feel compelled to make such a detailed public explanation of pending litigation. In conclusion, the band invoked Lesh's name, at the same time responding to his comments to the press that the Dead had simply become just another corporation. The statement concluded, "Finally,